I think the text is printed for you in the bulletin for this evening. So I invite you to draw your attention to Hebrews 5, verses 1 to 4. I've been reading some work on the chaplains that served in World War II. Over 900 of Protestant denominations, different Protestant denominations, and a number from Europe, and they often came from, or some came from, great cathedrals to serve on the battlefield. And that just put me to thinking that traditionally the old cathedrals are in the shape of a cross, and where the you're facing toward the east, where the Lord Jesus Christ will come in that great last day. But even the shape of the cross, and at least in the older traditions, the only person that was allowed to go up in there was the priest himself, and perform his duties there. And now we seem to have a better understanding of those things, and there's a sense in which we are all priests unto the Lord. But we do have a great high priest, one who is over and above us all, and he is the one that we're considering this evening, especially his qualifications. Notice with me then in Hebrews 5, verse 1. For every high priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. He can deal gently with the ignorant and wayward, since he himself is beset with weakness. Because of this, he is obligated to offer sacrifice for his own sins, just as he does for those of the people. And no one takes this honor for himself, but only when called by God, just as Aaron was. I think you have a six-point outline there covering those verses, but we'll just be considering 4 points of the six and the first two verses of this passage. We'll look at the origin of the office, the nature of the office, the purpose of the office, and then the qualification for the office. So notice with me, first of all, the origin of the office there in verse 1, that the high priest is chosen from among men. Not a supernatural being, no angel, so to speak. He's not an angel whose nature, think of it, an angelic nature, would be incapable of having the compassion that would be required while conducting the work of a priest. He'd be of an angelic nature, not flesh and blood. Also, think of the times when angels appeared to people on earth. For instance, look, you can recall the birth narratives in Luke. What happened when angels appeared to make these glorious announcements? Well, I think the word terror is used repeatedly in those passages. Think of when the angel appeared to Zacharias saying, you know, y'all have been childless, your wife will conceive. Well, he is about struck dead. Think of when the angel appeared to Mary. Again, she was frightened. Think of the shepherds. They're minding their own business with their flock, and all of a sudden there's all these angelic beings in the heavens. They are frightened out of their skin. So the high priest was not to be of angelic nature, but to be a human being. And our high priest has taken to himself our human nature. And even in the order of the Lord, it is necessary for the office and duty of a priest to be of a human being, not the least of which that provides a solid basis, a firm foundation of comfort for those he represents, of those for whom he's offered his sacrifice, those for whom he ever lives to make intercession. He knows us. He's one of us. He understands us, can identify with us. He is able to be tender and compassionate without being condescending. Well, the origin is of the office of the high priest, our great high priest, is he was chosen from among men. Notice, secondly, the nature of his office. And we read there that he is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God. Right there in verse 1. Think about it. When sin entered the world, then a priesthood became necessary. You know, how are sinful people to approach this great, holy God? Now, we would be unable to approach on our own. Now, if there were no sin, if there had been no fall, then there no atonement, no sacrifice would be needed. And there would be no need for a priesthood at all. Not only are sinful people unable to approach God on their own, but also nothing they do is suitable to please him. Oh, me. None of this, well, I'm going to try harder. I'll get it better next time. It doesn't matter. There's no next time. We have no other options. So, in the gospel story, there is surprising and unexpected grace on the part of God that God himself would set up an office so that we might approach him. And this, the priest is appointed on our behalf, on behalf of men. Notice, thirdly, the purpose of that office there at the end of verse 1. It is to offer gifts and sacrifices for sin. Gifts and sacrifices for sin. Here's a clear, very purpose statement. The language of sins is part of this vocabulary in the Bible, and this particular word means to miss the mark. You know, there's a bullseye, and no matter how many times you aim and shoot, you miss it over and over and over again. But our great high priest has hit the mark, on our behalf. This is the proper and primary purpose of the priest, to offer sacrifices, gifts for sin. From the very beginning, priests and sacrifices were so related that they could not be separated. The two go together. Again, the sacrifices were offered for or on behalf of sins. The missing of the mark. They were offered to God in order to make atonement. Atonement. It's a broad word. And within that concept of making atonement, there are these ideas. There's expiation, which is the removal of guilt. What do we do with our guilt before this holy God? We need it removed. There is propitiation. Wrath. There's anger because we have repeatedly, deliberately, self-consciously, premeditatedly broken his law. There's anger and wrath to be settled. What do we do with that? It's propitiation. But there's also reconciliation as the removal of the enmity, the distance, and the bringing about of restoration. All of that, y'all, is involved in atonement. multifaceted activity. Again, removal of enmity, restoration of relationship, removal of guilt, removal of wrath and anger. And atonement is kind of the broad general word, and these other concepts fall in under it. Our great high priest has made the final gift, the final sacrifice for sins, and has brought that all about. No wonder it's good for us to celebrate the Lord's Supper and remember His work, be reminded of it over and over again. Well, there's the purpose of His office to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. Notice fourthly in verse 2, now the qualification for the office. It says, He can deal gently with the ignorant and wayward, since He Himself is beset with weakness. Let's look at a couple of things under this fourth heading. Notice the necessary qualification to be a high priest. It is that so He can deal gently. He can deal gently. The idea there is that He has the ability, the temperament, the disposition not to be provoked, not to be exasperated. You think how often, how easily we become exasperated, you know. I remember a few times when our children were at home. You know, I've told you how many times not to do that. It's just kind of a part of our life here. We're given to exasperation and provocation. But our great high priest is not provoked, is not exasperated. You know, an ordinary priest, merely flesh and blood, was to control his anger. At least that. Christ controls His anger, yes. But it's more than that. He actively sympathizes with those He represents. There's that identification with us, actively sympathizes. He can deal gently. I remind you of the audience, the book of Hebrews again. Things are not going well for them. And Rome and her emperor and legions are ready to hunt down the Christians. And how dare you worship another God instead of giving your allegiance to the divine emperor? The emperor of Rome was not given to sympathy for the Christians. The Lord Jesus Christ, the King of Kings, is and was. Well, His necessary qualification, He actively sympathizes and can deal gently. Notice also the needy subjects. How are we described, y'all? Not very flattering. Notice again in our text, He can deal gently with whom? The ignorant, the wayward. Yep. His disposition described is exercised toward those who do not know how to live or do not know the right decisions at times, and those who are wandering, the wayward. It's interesting in the language of the text. The ignorant actually comes from a root of agnostic. I don't know. And the wandering comes from a word where we get our English word planet that was used to describe wandering stars in the sky. Those wandering planets. He's able to deal gently with such. Those who go astray through ignorance and those that are wandering. There are degrees of our infirmities and sins, you know, across all believers. But y'all, our weaknesses are not obnoxious to Him. They're not. You perhaps can remember being in school where you had an irritable teacher, or you could tell when he or she was having a bad day. That's not the time to say you didn't do your homework or confess to cheating on a test. No, no. I want to save that for another day. No. We know we identify ill-tempered people or know subjects or occasions where it's best to bring up something kind of touchy. That's never the case with our high priest. Never, never. We're not obnoxious to Him. You know, we all, again, we all fall under this description of the ignorant and wayward, one degree to another. Those are the needy subjects of the one who deals gently as our great high priest. Notice the reason behind this. There again in our text, verse 2. Since He Himself is beset with weakness. How about that? He Himself is beset with weakness. Here now is the reason for the preceding verses. How is He able to deal gently? This is why. He is beset. That's a rather colorful word in the New Testament. It's used in Acts 28 of Paul being laden with heavy chains. It's also used of in Luke 17, a story of Jesus talking about a person having a millstone tied around their neck and thrown into the sea. This idea of being weighed down with a heavy weight. The word beset is used in those two settings. The chains binding a person, Acts 28, or the millstone on a person when they're thrown into the sea, Acts 17. The Lord Jesus Christ is beset with what? With weakness. The idea here is that of a wearying weakness. It suggests that it is a burden that He bears on our behalf, our great high priest. Well, there's His qualifications for the work. You know, only the Lord knows our circumstances that we bring here. Again, a group this size, I would imagine there are plenty that feel their besettedness and are in need of one who is able to deal gently with them. Well, this text sets before us the only one that can, the only one that does, the Lord Jesus Christ Himself. And y'all, He's the head of the church. He's the boss man. He calls the shots. He's the ruler of all things on our behalf. And we look forward to His return when He will gather us to Himself. I think, Lord willing, though it's early, I'm going to stop there. And hopefully we'll cover the last two points later on. Okay. Just a final word again of atonement. I do want to remind you of these biblical words. They're just so rich. atonement involves a number of things. Again, in order to achieve a good relationship in the confrontation between the holy God and sinful humanity, then it is absolutely necessary that the factors that produce the enmity, produce the alienation, produce the hostility and distance must be removed. And this is achieved only by atonement. The wrath removed, the guilt removed, the enmity removed, and restoration brought back. It is through the work of the Son of God. Lord bless you all.